On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Today, such a fascinating topic and such a fascinating person to talk to. We're talking to Paul Crickmore, who was at the London Air Traffic Control Center, where he gained a unique introduction into SR-71 operations. He produced the first in-depth book ever to be published on the Blackbird. When more information became available to him in 1990, he came out with an even more detailed book, which became the standard reference work on the subject. This is Lockheed Blackbird Beyond the Secret Missions, The Missing Chapters, from Paul Crickmore from Osprey. Paul, it's a great privilege to get a chance to talk to you. And this is a big, beautiful book, just loaded with pictures and all. And the fact that you're able to talk about all this stuff probably means there's other things that neither one of us will have access to for some time that will be in future versions of this book. Thank you so much for making time to talk to me.
Doc, thank you very much indeed for the invitation to come and talk to you about my favorite subject.
The idea of being able to get intelligence on other nations without them discovering that you're doing it by mechanical or electronic means, this is a goal of every government on the earth since World War II.
So at the end of the Second World War, when the alliance between the Allied powers, particularly with the Soviet Union, began to all fall apart, it became apparent that, you know, an ally is now an adversary. And so along came the Cold War, pretty much. Initially, bombers, converted bombers, were used because they had the range and they were stripped of their armor and armament to get up higher. And they were used for gaining peripheral intelligence from the Soviet Union and some low penetration flights of the Soviet Union. But in October 1954, President Eisenhower accepted recommendations by his Blue Ribbon Committee to use aerial collection to gather strategic reconnaissance using covert overflights, which were actually flown by the CIA and not military Air Force pilots, which in and of itself is, you know, quite a change policy. He approved the use of a Lockheed U-2 to gain these high-altitude overflights. And on the 4th of July 1956, the first flight was conducted. But it became apparent immediately, actually, to the CIA that were monitoring the flight, that the flight was being tracked by Soviet radars. And indeed, attempts were even made on that first flight to shoot down this subsonic intruder. So from August 1956, a program involving, if you like, radar camouflaging was proposed, as methods were explored in an effort to reduce the U-2's radar signature. These were codenamed Rainbow. The project ultimately failed, and in January 1958, the Skunk Works boss, Kelly Johnson, and his team were tasked by the CIA in designing a U-2 replacement. The new program was called Project Gusto. Early models were put together, and there was a subsonic aeroplane, Gusto Model 2A. But from April 58, Johnson began to look increasingly at designs that put extreme speed and altitude performance at the heart of vehicle survivability, rather than what we now call stealth. 21st of April 1958, Kelly Johnson drew his first Archangel proposal for a Mark III cruise aircraft, having a range of 4,000 nautical miles and 90 to 95,000 foot. And over the following 20 months, he and his team worked on many different design iterations powered by different engine types and configurations. And they were designated A1 through A12. Eventually, as they were working through the designs, the U-2 carried on its mission on a very highly controlled basis by the CIA, and they were controlled by the president. And however, on the 1st of May 1960, it was proved to be a good thing to work on the replacement of the aeroplane, when on 1st of May, Gary Powers was shot down flying a U-2 by an SA-2, and he was over the middle of the Soviet Union. So they'd already been working on a replacement for the aeroplane. So and at that juncture, President Eisenhower banned all overflights of the Soviet Union by the U.S. End of story. So the question was, well, you know, we've already spent a lot of money developing this aeroplane, the A-12, the Oxcart. What are we going to do with it? 8 months before he was actually shot down, Lockheed's design was declared the winner of a design competition, which was between them and Convair. The Convair example was known as Fish, the first invisible super hustler. So that didn't fly at all. Oxcart was deemed the winner, and it first flew from Area 51, 25th of April 1962, with their Lockheed chief test pilot, Lou Shark, at the controls. So yeah, as I say, you know, what the heck are they going to do with this aeroplane? And as they were working it up and more aeroplanes were being delivered to Area 51, along came the Cuban Missile Crisis. U-2 was used to gain intelligence, as we all know of it. But unfortunately, on the 27th of October 62, another U-2 was shot down, this time being operated by the US Air Force. And that resulted in Major Rudolf Anderson being killed when the airplane was shot down. So by mid-1964, the A-12 had demonstrated its design speed and altitude capability. Four of the 13 airplanes that had been delivered up to Area 51 had been designated to collect strategic reconnaissance over Cuba, and that program was codenamed Skylark. However, the proposal was rejected due to bureaucratic infighting that had emerged between the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Secretary of Defense McNamara, and Secretary of State Vance, and DCI Director of Intelligence McCone, on the grounds that such missions might compromise the overall secrecy of the Oxcart program. The question remained, well, what are we going to do with this airplane? But in 1966, rumors began to circulate within the US intelligence community that the Soviet Union had supplied Scud and Shaddock surface-to-surface ballistic missiles to North Vietnam. So, if correct, this represented a significant strategic threat to the US military buildup then taking place in South Vietnam. So a body known as the Lookout Task Force established four priority search areas for those ballistic missiles. Much of those areas were actually located over in North Vietnam, around Hanoi and that sort of area. So existing reconnaissance platforms available, such as the U-2, the RF-101, the RF-4C and drones, that would be called upon to verify the existence of SAMs, were vulnerable to SA-2s and also FLAG. So looking then across at the possibility of using spacecraft to collect intelligence, the US were expanding its satellite capability under a project codenamed Corona. So the Keyhole KH-4 reconnaissance satellite acquired panoramic imagery. Problem with that is the resolution was between 6 and 24 foot, and it wasn't capable of identifying specific types of missiles. The KH-7 high-resolution satellite, much, much better resolution, was constrained by the number of targets that it could gather on a single mission. Like the A-12 sensors, well, both systems used film that needed to be recovered back to Earth and processed. But the overall factor on all of these considerations were both types were required actually to cover the gap, to bring about getting intelligence from the Soviet Union following the powers shutdown. So they weren't really available for work over North Vietnam. So there we have it. Oxcart was the aeroplane that was chosen to gather this vital intelligence. And so three facilities were readied at Kidina Air Base on the island of Okinawa. Three aeroplanes were positioned there, and Operation Black Shield began these missions, using the A-12 over North Vietnam, first of all to establish if there were any ballistic missiles. But as the program rolled on, increasingly the aeroplane was being used to identify SAM sites over North Vietnam, which obviously was used by US planners when they're planning raids over North Vietnam.
One thing we often misunderstand about the Blackbird and about its predecessors, the A-12 and the U-2, they were not offensive weapons. They were intelligence gathering for understanding what it is capable of doing, which is one of the fascinating things about the book, just how complicated it was to create all the components that contributed to the Lockheed Blackbird, the SR-71 program, being as wildly successful as it was and doing so many missions through the years of which no one else was aware, or if they were aware that something was happening, they still could never figure it out. None of the Blackbirds were ever shot down, for example.
One of the A-12s got very, very close to being shot down with a missile whilst it was flying over Hanoi. In fact, the CIA have two tiny pieces of, not even pellet from the warhead, but part of the rocket body, if you like, that punctured a wing fillet, and that's on display at Langley Air Force Base, at Langley, at Langley, Virginia, the headquarters of the CIA in their museum there. But yeah, none were actually shot down. And that was down to Kelly Johnson obviously identifying, you know, that speed and altitude could be a great savior when working in these high-risk environments.
So the Blackbird was developed as the A-12 is being retired in 1968, that the SR-71 takes its place. And it's flying even higher, even much faster, and barely shows up anywhere on anybody's radar. This is really an extraordinary accomplishment.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. So to fly so high and so fast, first of all, the material used is titanium. And indeed, so 93% of the unladen weight of the SR-71 is titanium. So the next question is, well, you know, we need rather a lot of this stuff. Where do we get it from? So the CIA and Lockheed established a load of front companies, and by using very, very circuitous routes, actually bought from the Soviet Union the titanium required to build the airplane that was going to be used to spy on the Soviet Union.
Gotta love the symmetry of that.
It's wonderful, isn't it? You know, you couldn't really write a novel and come up with that one, could you?
I was struck by how meticulous the construction parameters were for the Blackbird. I of course, am not an airplane designer, so maybe other people who read this will go, oh, well, of course it would do that. But for the novice, for someone who's just fascinated by it, it was amazing how every single detail had to be considered. You know, we see the Blackbird in this very spooky-looking airplane, say, oh, black, well, that's because it's stealthy. But that really wasn't the primary consideration for it even being that color.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's good old schoolboy physics, Kirchhoff's law radiation. You know, a black body is a good absorber, and a good absorber is a good emitter. You know, and so it will actually reduce the temperature of the airframe by painting it black by, they reckoned, maybe sort of 20 degrees Celsius or so, which, you know, when we're talking of temperatures, the coldest of which is about 250 degrees Celsius. So that's like the highest temperature on your broiler setting on your oven, a household oven. And then the areas adjacent to the afterburner section of the airframe will get up to about 500 degrees C. So, you know, you can imagine nothing else would be strong enough or indeed, you know, require the properties that would be light enough to build an airplane from. So that's hence the titanium we used. But then if you consider, well, how do you attach a piece of skin, you know, a thin titanium sheet to this much heavier subframe? And so the Skunk Works came up with a standoff clip that secured, you know, to the much bulkier structure, and it was like a standoff clip that they attached this skin to. And then they also put corrugations, longitudinal corrugations, on the wing panels, because what happened then was when the sheet expanded, those corrugations just got a few thousandths of an inch deeper. And then they would contract to the same size and shape as it were. If you did that to a normal sheet of titanium and attached it to substructure, it would just tear and warp, you know, as it got hotter, compared to the fact that the substructure was warming up much slower.
Now, one of the problems that you talk about in Lockheed Blackbird, Beyond the Secret Missions, The Missing Chapters, is something called pitch-up, which was about the only thing that ever took any of these things out. There were four aircraft in 26 years of the SR-71 program that were losses because of pitch-up. So explain what does that mean, and what could the pilot do, if anything, to try to avoid this?
Basically, a pitch-up is a stall, you know, which any airplane will do. If you put the nose up and you're not going fast enough to sustain, you know, air going over the aerofoil to keep it in the air, it will stall and fall out of the sky. So you're right, Doc. There were a few pitch-up accidents. One actually happened at Mark 3, and that was because during the early stages of the SR-71 development, they were finding that fuel burn was very high during the transonic regime, when you were going from subsonic to supersonic speed, burning up fuel. So they moved the center of gravity airplane further aft. It was going into a turn when it suffered an unstart. Okay, so now I'm going to have to explain right off the bat what that is, right? So the engine not only produced thrust, but the forward nacelle also produced thrust, and a lot of it. Okay, so now how did that happen? So as the air hit the spike, you know, those spikes that stick out of the nacelle, you get an angle off of the sonic flow, and then you'll get the supersonic flow bouncing, if you like, back and forth on inside the inlet. And it was positioned at the narrowest point of the inlet throat, because those spikes moved backwards as the airplane went faster. So the capture area increased, but the throat decreased. And right that minimum, that point of minimum cross-section at the throat, that's where the final terminal shock was put in place. And then the air was allowed to expand. By this time it was subsonic. It expanded and then went into the engine face. That area between the throat and the engine face was generating an internal pressure of about 14 pounds a square inch, when the ambient air pressure was about half a pound a square inch. So you had an enormous differential in pressure. And as you know, pressure goes from high to low pressure. So literally the aeroplane was being sucked along, if you like, by that pressure differential. Great when everything is working, but when those the pressure being held in place gets disturbed and it belches that shock wave out, you lose that pressure recovery instantly, and the aeroplane will yaw viciously in the direction of the unstarted engine. So this happened on a particular test flight, and with the center of gravity schedule further aft as well, you had not only this unstart, but you had a pitch up. And the whole aeroplane basically disintegrated, with the crew in the forward forebody, you know, that long bit that extends, you know, where the wings meet the fuselage, that snapped off. They found the ejection seats in the wreckage. Both crew members emerged on parachutes. One of them, the pilot, Bill Weaver, survived. And I interviewed him many, many years ago. He was introduced to me by the wonderful Ben Rich. Unfortunately, his backseater was killed. He died as the aeroplane broke up. He broke his neck, and unfortunately, he was found dead on the ground. There we have it, a horrendous pitch-up. And they think that what happened, the air was forced up the back end of the open fuselage, blew the cockpit's canopies off, and the crew threw their straps. And of course, they were actually strapped to the parachutes. Parachutes were barometrically opened as they came through the air. They had a stabilization chute, stop them spinning. Chutes opened at 18,000 foot, and down they slowly came. Yeah, so that's one horrendous pitch-up. A couple of others actually occurred, one due to an instrumentation failure, and another with an aeroplane getting rather slow, having taken on a full fuel load, and tried to climb above a saddleback of cloud down in Southeast Asia. Basically the aeroplane pitched up and crashed, but the crew members ejected safely.
This brings up two things. One is the in-flight refueling, which we'll take a moment to talk about, but also the fact that what these guys are doing, they're essentially astronauts on the edge of space. They're flying so high. And this is an extraordinarily dangerous thing to do for a living. And these guys were pretty doggone fearless to even put on what essentially looks like a Mercury-type spacesuit and get into this little bitty cockpit of this airplane and fly at vast speeds, very, very high up at the very utter stratosphere. This is an extraordinary kind of person that takes to do this. Second of all, most of us at somewhere along the line, if we've been around long enough, we've heard about refueling in progress, but this was a critical part of every mission, wasn't it? Because it just burned fuel so fast, they had to be refueled several times in a mission. This is really pretty extraordinary stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. The mission, most missions, I would say 95% of the operational missions required air refueling. There was occasionally flown from Kadena a mission where the airplane would take off and go straight over the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea and return. But, you know, that was very, very seldom flown. Yeah, most of the time the airplane would actually get airborne with about half tanks, rendezvous with a KC-135 that had specialist communication equipment on board. So it was designated a KC-135Q, and it would take on the special fuel that it had, the JP-7 fuel, which had a much, much higher burn than the normal JP-4 that you would use in a normal airliner, for instance. Had to have a much higher burn because, of course, we were saying about the temperature, the skin temperature of the tanks. You know, normal fuel would actually ignite in the fuel tanks if you used JP-4, hence using JP-7. Wow. And the specialist KC-135Q tankers to look after the fuel requirements. But, yeah, you know, you've got to bear in mind that this aeroplane, that when it was conceived and built, the context of frontline jets was the F-100, F-101 Voodoos, really. And here we're taking a giant leap into the technical unknown, and the aeroplane was having to cruise in afterburner. That was the most efficient speed of the aeroplane, was Mach 3.2. So Mach 3.2 is about 2,250 miles an hour sustained. And this is before, you know, the days where you had the supercruise, like the Concorde and like the Raptor these days, for instance, that can supercruise and fly supersonic speed without the use of afterburner. The SR couldn't do that, but, you know, by using this devilishly fiendish system of the air intake and the back end, actually the ejector nozzle, it produced much more additional thrust than you would normally get out of a typical aeroplane that only used afterburner to get those speeds up.
It's really an extraordinary accomplishment to design and build and maintain and use these kind of planes. The SR-71 program was discontinued. We assume, I think that's a safe assumption to make, that there's probably something else newer and cooler, and we'll learn about that in 10 or 20 years. And if Paul and I are both still around, he'll write about it and we'll talk about it.
That sounds like a plan, Doc.
So certainly there is a really excellent reason to continue these kind of programs.
Yeah, there is. You know, some of the stuff that the SR-71 was getting up to at the height of the Cold War, as an example, was monitoring the Soviet Northern Fleet that were based all around the Barents Sea. The US Navy prided itself on keeping tabs on the Soviet boomers because Soviet naval policy had adopted to a stage where they'd established two bastions, if you like, one around the Barents Sea, the other one around Petropavlovsk. So in the case of the Barents Sea, they were ice-free ports, despite being way up in the Arctic Circle, submarines would come out of their pens and they could fire intercontinental ballistic missiles over the North Pole and take out virtually any target along the eastern seaboard of the United States. So not surprisingly, the US Navy were very, very interested in keeping close tabs on where those Soviet boomers were. And the SR was very much involved in helping to provide information to the US Navy on where the subs were. It would fly around the Barents Sea in international airspace, Mark III, using its highly powerful synthetic aperture radar, had a resolution of a foot, maybe a bit less. And even though the subs were in the pens, the way that the radar would ricochet around the walls of the pens, those very intelligent, very highly gifted PIs could tell whether there was a sub in there or not. So they were able to keep track and give that information to the US Navy. So, yeah, there is always a need to get that information. Satellites can be tracked. You put a man in an aeroplane, you don't know exactly where it's going to go, how it's going to get there. So it's much more difficult to track. So, yeah, this is where, you know, back in the 1980s and the 1990s, the SR, you know, cut one above what the satellites could do.
Well, this is quite an extraordinary book, Paul, and I'm so glad that we were able to get a chance to talk about it and to let people know the amazing story of these highly secretive and brilliantly designed and executed airplanes, and the courageous men that made them and the courageous men that flew them. Thank you so much for making time to talk to us all the way from your home in England. Is there anything else that you'd hope that I'd ask about that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
Can I just say about the crews? The guys that flew the SR-71, the pilot, and the RSO, the reconnaissance systems officer, they really were at the top of their game. They were extremely professional pilots, you know, really at the top of the game, as were indeed everyone that was associated with that aeroplane. This aeroplane was highly complex, as you get the idea, it certainly was. And so the guys that were charged to maintain this incredibly complex aeroplane and the systems operator systems on it, you know, the inertial navigation system, because it didn't have, you know, a GPS, wasn't around in those days. Right. It had a special satellite, it had an astro navigation system, so it would star track and cross check with an inertial system for accuracy. So very, very complicated systems. So everyone involved really were and had to be at the top of their game.
Paul, thank you so very much, first of all, for continuing the story and coming out with newer editions of and adding to the body of knowledge that you created for those of us outside of the U.S. military who are fascinated by this. As a Cold War kid, I can tell you this explains a lot of very interesting things that happened when I was younger, and I always wondered, how did they know or how did they do this? Fascinating reading. You took really very complicated things and made them discernible for those of us who are not airplane designers or pilots. I thank you for that. When I told a friend of mine who is retired from the Air Force and told me that he used to fly the tankers, and he did actually fly in a Blackbird a time or two, I told him about the book. He said, well, he said, you'll have to loan it to me. I may learn some things. I'm going to send him the link so he can get a copy for himself. Thank you, Paul. It's been a great pleasure.
Doug, thank you very much indeed for the opportunity to talk to what I honestly believe was the United States' premier airplane project of the 20th century.
Paul Crickmore, our guest today on The Bookshelf. His new book, Lockheed Blackbird, Beyond the Secret Missions, The Missing Chapters. It's from Osprey Publishing. It's available in bookstores and online. It's a magnificent read, and if you're like me and you're fascinated by what in the world went on in the skies above us, you won't want to miss the opportunity to have a copy of this and to read for yourself. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Check out the podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com and our website, wtbfradio.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless.